Hello, hello, hello. This is Tooth Be Toad. This is Dr. Walter Aka.
And y'all remember me, Leroy Horton?
I'm Dontre Scott. Nice to meet everyone.
Yes, sir. So, you know, Dr. Scott is an alum. He's been on this podcast, and we were actually just talking about when he came on the podcast. It was like we were at the beginning of this. We're like, we actually used to hang out at one of our buddies' office, and we would, you know, we'd have a few drinks and have a good time and just kind of talk dentistry. So he's been on there multiple times. But I haven't gotten him to come on and talk about his journey, which I think is an amazing journey, which, you know, a lot of people get out of school, get out of residency. He's a board certified endodontist. He's a speaker. He has his own practice. He does a lot of things. So we're not going to talk about any of that. We're going to talk about his journey, you know, through dentistry and through as a specialist, as an endodontist, where he traveled as an endodontist, went to different offices, working with corporations, working in private offices, and then opening up his own practice. You know, to me, I think that's just that's what the story needs to be, is basically his journey and what he found to be beneficial, what he found not to be beneficial, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So, Dr. Scott, we really appreciate you coming on again.
Of course, man. Thanks for the invite, guys. I'm excited to get this conversation going.
Yeah, man. He's a good friend of mine, so I'm biased in a lot of aspects, but I'm gonna try my best to stay back while he kind of educates the population.
But yeah, and the thing that you pointed out that was really key was that it's a journey, and no one person's journey is the same. But it's real important that we all share our journey, so that way you can kind of, you know, figure out what works best for you.
That's it. Now, so tell us, I mean, we'll start with whenever you moved to the Houston area. When you moved to the Houston area, what were you doing when it came to looking for a job? What were you doing when it came to how you found your position or whatever it may be? Let's start with that.
Okay. I kind of want to just step back just a little bit. So I did my dental school at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and then I went to NYU for endo. And when I was at NYU, one of the alumni was looking for an associate, and he actually had a practice in San Antonio. So that's how I got to Texas. So my I moved from New York City to San Antonio. Needless to say, I was only there for about a year because it was a huge difference. San Antonio and Manhattan are pretty polar opposites.
Big difference.
Wait, but where are you originally from?
I'm originally from Maryland, Columbia, Maryland, so the Washington, D.C. area. Originally went to University for undergrad.
Mm-hmm. So definitely a city boy for the most part.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I mean, I grew up in a suburb, but yeah, I got a city heart for sure. I just like that vibe and the action, you know. But I got to San Antonio. Now, I didn't move to the suburbs. I moved like right off the Riverwalk. So I lived in San Antonio. Even after a while, it got a little boring. I loved my job. I was working as an associate in a private endo office. There was just one other doctor there, and he was kind of just showing me the ropes, you know, as far as how he ran his office. And for me, that was my first like real job as an endodontist. You know, I had did a GPR and I did moonlighting and stuff like that, but that was my first real job. So needless to say, I got hit with a bag of bricks, because real life endodontics and private practice is not easy. It's tough. And I had just got out of residency. So, you know how to do stuff, but you're not seasoned, you know? So I got thrown in, and he wasn't pushing me to do more than I could or anything of that sort. It was just, I felt that pressure on me. Like, you know, I want to be a good doctor. I want to be a good associate. So I worked hard, but the cases were usually pretty difficult. So they took longer, and it just, you know, it was like an up and down for me that first year, where, you know, your confidence would get really high when you had good cases. But then when those really hard ones come, you'd be like, man, this is tough, you know? So that was a journey for me for sure.
So real quick, let me ask you, you said something that was very interesting. It kind of triggered me. You said when you were working, some of those cases were really hard. In residency, were you getting those kinds of cases there too?
Yes, but residency, as we all know, residency is different, right? You only got to see like maybe two or three patients in a day in residency, you know, maximum. You might see four if you've got easier ones. But when you have harder cases in residency, the patients come to the dental school already knowing that it's going to take a little longer to do. So you don't have to actually push yourself to finish the case. You know, you can say this is a two visit, or this might be a three visit, you know, if it's a little bit tougher, or your professor kind of pushes you in that direction. So
and that's what I was trying to get people to understand this. Like when you're in residency, you kind of have a lot more leniency when it comes to patients' expectations. And then also what you want to do. Hey, this is going to take 3-4 hours, right?
Right.
And in private practice, you can't just say, oh, it's going to take 3 or 4 hours. Like right. You have other factors that go into it, productivity and so forth, right?
Exactly. You got bills.
There you go. I didn't want to say it like bills. That.
And for our non-dental friends, when it comes to an endodontist, you're doing root canals, you're a specialist, highly trained specialist in root canals, and you're not really getting sent the easy peasy ones, right? You're sending ones that are already difficult. That's why someone either passed on them or attempted them and messed things up. And now you're going back in there to clean up the mess and finish it properly. So these are the hardest of the hardest cases that are actually coming across your plate.
Exactly. So like I said, that first year was more about me just learning the ropes of being in a private setting, you know, outside of a school setting or outside of like a moonlighting type setting. And then just getting used to dealing with the patient load as far as, you know, the difficult cases and things like that. But then my wife's job situation changed. So we were looking to move to Houston. And I got approached by basically a recruiter, if you want, or just somebody who was involved in a corporation, a dental corporation, DSO. Mm-hmm. And they're always looking for people, right? They've got they pretty much own, you know, I guess out of 4 offices, they probably own 2 to 3 of them now at this point.
It's getting like there. It's getting there. Yeah.
But they approached me with, you know, I had been a year out of school. I was doing well, and now that I look back on it, I actually really enjoyed that job. I just didn't have kids, and I just left New York, so I had to get out of San Antonio. But looking back on it, it was actually pretty cool. I'd be okay with that now as a 40-year-old. But anyway, so she approached me with an offer that was pretty hard to turn down. You know, as far as the money that I'd be getting, the you know, supplies that they would at least initially, you know, set me up with. And just some of the tax benefits that I would get as far as switching from a W-2 employee at my private office I was at to being a 1099, basically running my own business, you know, with the corporation. So that's how I kind of got drawn into the Houston market.
And as with the corporation, you were going to start traveling, right? Going to different offices.
Right. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so that's another mindset like shift. You had to basically go from one office, right? Coming out of school, you're one office, and now you're going to be seeing multiple offices. So talk us through that whole mindset shift now as you began that process.
Yeah, sure. So I had been married by then about, let's say, 3 years. So still kind of young in the marriage. We didn't have any kids yet. I was still young, and I call myself like an ambitious dentist, if you want to use that word. Like I'm hungry. I'm out here. I'm ready to work, you know? So I said, let's do it. So basically what I did was I moved to the center of Houston, and they told me each one of my offices would be about on average about a 35 to 45 minute commute from where I lived. And I just hit a different office every day. But I'd be responsible for managing, you know, my supplies, and things of that sort. So they definitely supplied me with everything up front. I was very adamant about I needed a microscope, which was something at first that they were not trying to do in this region. I think I might have been the first endodontist to basically make that the standard, because each office would have had to like invest in getting a stand to hold the microscope, and I was just going to be responsible for taking the actual optical part around. Mm-hmm. So once they supplied me with everything, which, by the way, I do want to mention to anyone who is considering this, it was a loan. They supplied me everything via a loan, so I had to pay it back over a year out of my, you know, production costs. But it was an upfront loan, no interest, so it wasn't a bad deal, at least not to me.
And you got to keep it up at the end, right?
Right.
It's yours,
right. Okay. So I actually that microscope is actually hanging up in my office right now. It's an older model, but it works just fine.
so if anybody needs a microscope.
That's in my third operatory. And then, like I said, I have all the motors and all that stuff. But after that, it's all about the, you know, stuff that you use continuously. So I had to supply that, you know, afterwards on my own. I would travel basically at the beginning. I actually had a lot of offices at the beginning. I was at a different office every day for 2 weeks. So I had about 10 offices that I was covering. I was working Monday through Thursday most times, but some days I would work on Fridays, depending, you know, like on what the office had to offer.
Okay, so you went from, you mentioned at From a W-2 to a 1099, you said there was benefits there.
Right.
What are some of those benefits? And then were they as promised? Were the benefits really as beneficial as promised by the DSO at the time?
So the benefits that the DSO sold me really had nothing to do with the DSO. You know, it was the fact that I got to start my own business and I got to funnel, you know, all the cost and everything associated with running that business through my own business. And it taught me a lot about taxes, how to make sure I'm, you know, strategizing appropriately with my taxes. But it also taught me how to actually run like a micro office, because I had to keep my supplies on point, you know, make sure I had enough to get through, you know, month by month or quarter by quarter, which is how I usually used to do it, quarter by quarter. It taught me a lot as far as that goes. And it also taught me how to deal with different staff members, because depending on which office I went to, I may have a new assistant with me, or just a new front desk. So it really taught me a lot. So I don't want to say they gave me any business benefits, you know, as far as the 1099. It was all just kind of, I guess, a side. But
Kind
she,
of experiential
right.
learning gave you a good learning curve for your future private business. Okay.
Exactly. Now they did promise, you know, a lot of patient load, which would, you know, that in turn means more production for me as a provider. And I can say they did hold up the end of the bargain there for the most part. You know, most of the offices I went to had a pretty full schedule, you know, based on how I liked to schedule at the time, and I was able to have a pretty productive schedule for the most part.
Okay.
So Dr. Horton and I have been talking about productivity, right? And one thing that we keep mentioning is having consistency when it comes to training your assistants to do exactly the way you want to do it, right? And having consistent assistants will make you more productive, will make your life a lot easier, right? We all can agree on that. You mentioned how each office you go to, you may have different assistants. Talk about that and how difficult that was for you to then build and grow from that
Yeah, no problem.
production-wise, and
Yeah, no
the
problem.
challenges that's associated with that. And did they also tell you that that might be the case?
No. So when I signed up, they did not say that might be the case. Okay. So I don't want to say it's all negative, my
No,
experience.
no, no, no.
I
We're
mean,
just kind of trying to walk through the whole process, right? They're
yeah.
good and bad. You
Right.
mentioned the good about production, having patients in the office for you, right? Versus you having to go out and get patients, they kind of have it for you. But there has to be other parts that you'd mentioned that we want to kind of talk about.
Oh yeah, for sure. I gotta put this out there. I've worked for pretty much, in my eyes, like the four major DSOs. I've worked for all of them.
That's why you're here. That's why you're
Yeah.
here.
So one of them was actually pretty good. They said, we're gonna try to hire some DAs for you, two DAs at least for you that would agree to
Yeah.
travel around with you and be your team.
Yeah.
And
DA's dental assistant for people
dental
that don't know.
assistants, yes, I'm
Yeah.
sorry, dental assistant. To travel around with me, and they would be your team. And that DSO actually, they did hold that promise. That I did have a team with me that was actually pretty consistent for a number of years, actually.
Right.
And I think that was partially luck, because the young women at the time that were working with me, they were, you know, they were reliable individuals. They wanted to come to work. They didn't have families yet, so they were traveling with me, and it was all good. If I wanted to work longer hours, they were fine with it. And actually, those two individuals stayed with me for probably about 5 years straight. And they were with me, you know, pretty much every day. Now, the other ones, I can't say that. The other ones that I work with, I actually never had the same the DA. She's one DA stayed with me for about maybe 6 months. But, you know, as we probably talk about later, corporations have some issues behind them. So she got frustrated, and I tried to coach her through it, but she didn't work for me, so I didn't actually really care, to be honest with you. She didn't work for me. I didn't have a true investment in her. So I told her, I actually encouraged her to go find another job, you know, because she was a great DA, but I felt her pain, you know, so I didn't want her to seriously be in that situation. So that's one of the cons I will say anyone considering being a traveling, you know, either general dentist or specialist. You may be working with someone that you've never laid eyes on before, who actually may have never even assisted any dentist before. I've worked with fresh out of school, first
Right.
day on the job DAs, and here I am trying to, you know, run this jam-packed schedule that they put in front of me. So, like Walter said, it definitely challenges your production.
Right. Right. And so with something like that, did you have the flexibility to say, okay, you know, we got to cut back on these patients? I mean, because again, we can't do much with maybe a you know, an assistant that does not know endodontics.
So I'll be honest with you guys, when I first started out, I was, like I said, I was hungry and I was ambitious. So I'm the guy who, you know, we got a full schedule. We only got one DA that's actually competent or whatever have you. I'm gonna be back there flipping the room. Like if I gotta flip the room, I'm gonna flip the room. You know, if I gotta tape some barrier tape, wipe some stuff down, Cavi-Wipe, whatever have you, I'm gonna be that guy. And also I'll be the guy in the instrument room, you know, bagging out my instruments because I pay for those instruments, you know, and I can't have you losing them, breaking
That's it.
them, you
That's it.
know, bagging them incorrectly because I gotta move to another office tomorrow that's totally separate from you. And I need them to be able to find my stuff in an organized fashion. So yeah, I was that guy for a while. I'll say for a while because it kind of got old, you know, and that kind of led me to where I am now, obviously, as far as private practice goes. But yeah, there were days when, like, if I had one assistant and it was jam-packed, I would start cutting patients down. So, you know, it's just not, because it wasn't fair to the assistant either. She never got a lunch break, which is, I'm sure, illegal. You know, and I didn't get a break.
Mind you, Dr. Scott knows that rule book in and out. He's trying to act like he doesn't.
You know, but I don't actually take a lunch. I actually work through lunch every single day if possible. And that's just for my own, you know, whatever. I just don't like to eat, but during the day. But the DAs, they need at least 30 minutes, like to kind of, you know, regroup. And you know, some of them they like to, you know, take their lunch break. But yeah, so as I said, as the years went on, I couldn't keep doing that. You know, it was wearing me down. Here I am getting there at 7:30 in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, to set up. First patient comes in and I'm working all the way through and we're leaving out of there at 6. I mean, I've worked a whole day, you know, and then I got to do that every single day. You know, it gets old, man. It gets old. It was tiring.
What do you think about when you look at burnout on yourself, burnout on staff? What would you consider? How much value would you put on building a healthy culture of, yes, we're working hard, but there's not really a benefit to just be balls to the wall all the time? You know, because you hear those motivational speakers that you got to be grinding, you got to be doing this, you got to, you know, wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and do all that. But you also have to still love where you go to every day. And when work starts becoming an internal anxiety, like, oh God, I got to go to work today. Even if you like your job, retention is going to be hard. So how long into the game did you realize, like, okay, I have to find a balance between how hard I'm working or I'm working my staff and my personal well-being and their well-being?
I'm going to tell you, my mindset started to shift about, like I said, about 5 years out of residency. So maybe like right, actually, to be honest with you, my mindset really started to shift right before COVID hit. It started, you know, feeling that this isn't right. This isn't the way I'm going to be able to practice long term, you know. And I started seeing, like I was telling you earlier, turnover on dental assistants, turnover on front desk. Just because they're being overworked or the conditions aren't, you know, favorable for them. So I say it took me a solid like 4 or 5 years before I started really prioritizing, you know, that balance, like you said. And that's right around the time I had a kid. I had a kid right before COVID, like 2019. So that's when I started realizing, man, I got a family now. I need to be there, you know, for them. I can't be working and then driving, you know, an hour. I live in Houston, man, so the traffic is real. You know, we get off at 5:30, I'm not getting home till like 7, you know. So once I had a kid, I think that really kind of put things in perspective for me. But to go back on your other point, as far as like the burnout for the staff, I've always been the kind of guy who's just been like, you know, I'm a realist. I know that life is happening outside of this office. But I always tell my team, like, this is work. I don't want to come to work. I'm a dentist. I like what I do, but I don't want to be at work. I'd rather be at home, just like you'd rather be at home. But we are here. We're here to help our patients, and we got to work together. If you got something personal going on, all I ask is that you communicate with me so we can make it work as a team. Because it's just not fair to everyone else to like just pull your weight if you're not communicating. So that's kind of how I approach things as far as that goes.
So, you know, one thing that I always talk about is whenever you're running a business, you have to know your numbers. You have to know like what's coming in, what's going out, right? And as somebody who travels from office to office, talk about the communication aspect of getting your schedule, getting your, you know, getting your, you know, and I laugh because I kind of, we've had this discussion so many times, getting your schedule, getting basically what the production looks like, being able to be prepared for that day, right? Because you're not at that office to look at the x-ray all the time and so forth. So talk about that, that, you know, how easy was it? How hard was it? Whatever it may be. Talk about that.
Yeah. So I want to preface this with saying that every region of every DSO, as we're calling them, are is different.
Right.
I'm talking on the Texas region. But there are
we're talking about regions. Houston. We can only talk about Houston.
Right. Right. But I have spoken to other people in different regions, and I find the similarities that run deep. But basically, when you work in a DSO, it's a corporation. So many of us are dentists. We've never worked in a corporate setting. There's people who are sitting behind a desk that have no idea about dentistry, but they're running the business aspect of the dentistry. And then they may hire people in the front desk as an office manager, a benefits coordinator, treatment coordinator, whatever term you want to use, to basically run the day-to-day of an office. And they also may have no dental knowledge or training. Some of them are like putting office manager positions, and they don't even know what a occlusal filling is. They're just an office manager of a dental office now. So you can imagine how that could be frustrating. Now, that's not all my offices here in Houston. I had some that were already established, and I'm coming in, and they know what they're doing. So what I would do is I would say, you know, if you would oblige, send me.
So would you oblige? Okay. That's exactly how you talk, right?
send me some periapicals, please. A decent periapical, which you'd be surprised how many of the DSO dentists were diagnosing off of terrible x-rays, periapicals and bite wing of every tooth if you can. And a lot of times they couldn't because they had bad x-rays. So sometimes I'd be walking in to, you know, the day, and I'm looking at the x-rays that they have for the first time, you know, and not knowing. So some cases I will say this, you know, I had a lot of autonomy in the DSO up to a point. And so I was able to like tell patients, you know, I'm a specialist. I don't believe that this is the setting for this case to be treated. I think you need to go see a private endodontist, go to their office. They've got all the tools they need. They have the time. They've got the DAs and the assistants that can actually get this case treated for you successfully. But that was like a daily thing for me. I had to get into the office. I had to look at all the x-rays. I had to make sure, you know, we could have a successful day. It was a case that actually I could complete in one, maybe two visits, which is like the, you know, that's like the hush word in DSO. I don't like that word, two visit. But, you know, sometimes you have some cases like that. So it was a challenge, man. It was really a challenge. They would get frustrated with me. It was like I was asking them for $1 million. I'm like, I just want the x-rays. I just want the schedule. And the reason the schedule was important for me is because I was a 1099. So I did have multiple gigs going on. So I could go to office from 8 to 12 and I'd be done. If you don't have any other patients, I'm leaving and I'm going to go somewhere else from 2 to 6, you know, to cover my day. You know, like I said, I was hustling earlier in my career. So that's why I was really like, you know, sticky on the schedule, because I'm like, you know, you guys aren't paying me a salary. So my time is my time. If you don't have a patient, I'm not hanging around. So, you know, that's the only reason I was really stickler on the schedule.
Are DSOs stingy on remote access? Because I got four offices they're all private offices that I travel through on my weekends. And I have remote access to all their computers. So I can always log in ahead of time, look at the schedule, look at the x-rays, look at the patient history and all that. DSOs not allow that?
Back when I first started, it was a little harder, but as technology has gotten better and easier and they've switched over to different systems, yes, you do have some DSOs that allow you to have that kind of mobile access. Some of them make you buy like a separate computer where you can only look at their stuff on their computer. You won't be able to access like anything else on it, you know, for security reasons, obviously. But when I first started in the Houston region, that was not possible. We weren't able to have like that digital, you know, at home type access.
Gotcha.
So you mentioned something that was kind of also very interesting. You said that you would tell patients, hey, this is not something that I could do in this corporate setting, in this private office? Because most of the time it's a general practice that you've come in, you're like a guest in that office, right? So you mentioned that this is not something that you can do in this office. Tell me, what were some of the things that you would look at to say, yeah, I can't do this here. You have to go to a private office in order to do that, because this private office would have something that you don't have, because you're both trained endodontists. And I want people who don't know, like, what you're thinking to kind of explain that.
So for me, it's the key that I want everyone who's listening to know is about case selection. Mm-hmm. You need to know what you're looking at preoperatively before you go in there, you know, and try to, you know, attempt that treatment. And that's what it came down for me. If there was cases that were severely calcified that I literally couldn't see any canal at all, they had already previously separated instruments, if they looked like really difficult retreatments, if they needed apical surgery, something that I just knew needed more time, more follow-up, you know, just more step-by-step that I wasn't going to be able to provide. Because mind you, I'm at this office on Monday. I'm not coming back again for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I live around the corner. I live 45 minutes to an hour away. So you won't be able to see me again. You have to come travel to another office that I'm at, if it's even associated with that particular DSO that I'm at that day. You know, so that's the reason I was like more of a stickler on, you know, what cases I would attempt and what cases I wouldn't. Because at first, when I first got out, I was thinking I could just do everything,
right?
Or just because I was trying to do everything. But then like I said, once you experience certain things, you're like, hold on, I probably shouldn't have done that. And I probably shouldn't do that moving forward. So that's when I started doing that. And, you know, for me, that was the biggest turnoff to the DSO, because DSOs want, you know, generally speaking, you know, if you're a decent endodontist, pretty good endodontist, you should be in there seeing patients basically on the hour, 1 hour, 1 hour, 1 hour, 1 hour. You should be able to see probably about like 8 root canals a day, you know, generally speaking at a DSO. So they want you to be able to see those 8 root canals and complete those 8 root canals. You know, that's the production. They want to slam the crown on there that day or the next day. So they need that patient in and out. So if it was a case that I looked at after I had done, you know, a decent amount of cases, and I look at it and say, man, I can't do this in that time that I know they want me to do it, you might want to go see somebody else. Mm-hmm. So that's where it started getting dicey, you know, with some of the DSOs, when that autonomy of mine started getting challenged. That's when my line gets drawn.
Politically, when you see, because I don't know, Walt could probably identify with this. Let's say someone refers to us for an implant, and we might see a whole host of factors that tell us this patient isn't quite ready, right? But if you're a traveling doctor, like you said, they want production. They built a schedule for you in their mind works.
Right.
They may not have the system set up, they, you know, the properly trained assistants. What does it look like for you communicating with either the partner dentists at the DSOs or the associates when they might send you a tooth and you're looking at it and you're like, I'm not sure this is a case that, you know, this tooth would benefit from a root canal, or is it even restorable, let alone should I do a root canal on it? How did you handle those more sensitive conversations where you might be challenging someone's decision that they've made on a certain patient?
Well, the good thing about the DSO setting, for sure, which is positive, is that your referring dentist is right there. The one who's sending you the cases is right in the office with you. I mean, I love that about it, for sure. You just walk around the corner and say, hey, Dr. Jones, you know, you sure about this tooth? It looks, in my opinion, you know, questionable or whatever have you. I don't think prognosis is the best. And, you know, there were some cases where we would agree, and there were some cases where we would disagree. And that's when we would get the patient involved. You know, I'm in the business of saving teeth if it can be saved, you know, and if the patient understands and has reasonable expectations. But a lot of dentists, for the most part, in the DSO settings were kind of a little bit new to the game as far as practicing. So that also made the conversations a little bit easier, because they're kind of learning from me as far as how, you know, specialists work. But the only ones I would run into issues with, obviously, would be the ones who are a little bit more seasoned, and Captain Sabretooth, they can restore anything, you know. So those are the only ones I would be like, are you sure? You know, that margin is way down there, you know, and they'd be like, oh, I got it, doc. So, and that was before the margin elevation stuff started coming around, you know. I'm just like, okay. Right. But, you know, those conversations are tough no matter what. Even in my private setting, you know, it's almost like, at least it seems like to me, it's like, oh, if I send it to you, you know, go ahead and do it and I'll figure it out after that, you know. And I just wasn't trained that way, so that's where it was a little bit tough for me.
Okay.
So A lot of people, you know, talk about what corporations, and I want you kind of debunk it or agree to it or whatever it may be, but they talk about how they feel pressured to be productive. They feel pressured to do things, right? And, you know, when you're coming out of school, it's your first job or whatever it may be, not as seasoned as you guys are, but when you're coming out, do you feel like you felt pressured to, like you said, you know, you like, hey, they're coming in, they want me to do this endo, and it should take me two appointments, but maybe I can just get it done in one. And you learn from that. Was that something that you felt pressured initially, or you kind of sensed that pressure from the office manager, whoever it may be?
Definitely, definitely. I'm not going to lie at all. I felt pressure that I had to produce from them and from me, you know,
Hmm.
because I had my own expectations as far as what I was trying to accomplish, but I definitely had expectations set upon me from the DSOs. And each one was different as far as what they were looking for and what they were expecting. So it got to the point for me, you know, I worked for one DSO and then I had another one on kind of like part-time. And then when the relationship I left the first one, I was started going to others. When I would interview, I would tell them straight up, I would say, you know, are you looking for someone to come in and do efficient endodontics? Or are you looking for someone to run an endodontic practice out of your DSO? Because that's two different mindsets, that's two different practitioners.
Break that down real quick.
What I mean by that is efficient endodontics is one visit, pretty straightforward cases that can be done and, you know, can be managed. Endodontic practice is everything else. Retreatments, calcified cases that might take 3, 4 hours, you know, apical surgeries, all that type of stuff. That's an endodontic practice, you know, consultations just to do consultations, you know, like stuff like that. That's what we do in our private practice. But if you want me to come in and do efficient endodontics, one molar an hour, you got to set it up a certain way so that it can flow, you know, that way. Otherwise, we're all going to be sitting here banging our heads up against the wall.
Okay. One thing I found is that things always start out great when you start talking with new bosses. Like, oh yeah, totally. We'll support you. We'll give you what you need. You know, we won't put the patients first. And like anything else, when the honeymoon is over, you're only being judged on those production numbers at each sheet, right? Have you taken from that in your own private practice and said, okay, like clearly there's a nut I got to crack every month. I got to pay rent, I got to pay, you know, payroll benefits and all that. What were the mind shifts when you went from being an employee? And 1099 is kind of semantics with us. You're still technically an employee to a degree, right? But when you're your own true business owner, when you have a brick and mortar and you have payrolls, like things change. What were some of the mind shifts you saw both pro employee and then pro owner, where you might have been like, okay, I get what that owner was saying now, because now I'm in that position with that responsibility.
It's a huge mind shift, man. I'm not even gonna lie. Like, you know, anyone, if you practice in a DSO setting for a long time and you try to switch over to private, you're gonna have to make an adjustment for sure. And then not only that, and now I'm the owner of the office. So like you were saying, it's a huge mind shift. But for me, I am trying to put my patients first, and I am trying to put my staff first because I want to keep my staff. You know, I realize having the same staff is like super valuable.
Yes.
So I've been working with the same staff for the most part. I lost one employee, but since I opened up my private office, so we've had the same staff for like 4 straight years, and I'm knocking on wood because I'm hoping that we can keep them around, you know, as long as possible. But yeah, you do have production goals that you want to meet, but you know, you don't want to compromise your treatment or compromise your ethics or anything like that. So I always feel like it's going to work itself out as long as you're doing your best and you're doing good things. I feel like all your bills eventually will get paid. But one thing I did learn from the DSO in particular that helped me in my private office is you got to know how to manage your business, your overhead. Like those DSOs do not manage overhead. They just have an unlimited supply of cash and they just burn it, you know? So that's a reason, that may be a reason why they need so much production because they're just burning cash. You know, I can't go too deep into some of the information I'm privy to. They need help running their financial side of their business. And that may take a little bit of the load off as far as, you know, produce.
Right.
So can I ask, and again, you know, you and I, we've talked so many times, but what was that mind shift? What was that switch that basically said, I'm done traveling? I'm done working with these DSOs. I need to transition. And I say that because, you know, when you have a kid, you mentioned that when you have a kid, your mind changes, right? We know that you have to change your mindset no matter who you are. But I want to know when you said, I'm done with this, I'm going on my own. Because that's a big, like you said, that's a big, you know, shift in just mindset and lifestyle and everything.
So it's funny you asked that. So it was actually two events that occurred. Well, three. I had my son. The second event was I was on my way to an office, which is about an hour from my house, and I had a nice 528 BMW. It
Uh-oh.
was nice, man.
Uh-oh.
And
And I can attest to that. It was a
flexing.
beautiful
He's flexing.
car. I could attest to that.
But I was on my way to work, and this guy, I mean, he wrecked my car. I mean, it was total. He totaled my BMW. My equipment luckily was in the perfect spot of the car where he didn't hit that part, so none of my equipment got damaged, but my car was totally wrecked. I'm shaking up. I'm just like, whoa, you know, I'm on my way to work. It's rush hour. People are looking. I'm calling the cops, whatever. So, and then I finally thought about it. Oh man, I need to call the owner doctor and let him know that I'm probably not going to make it, you know?
Right. You just had an
So
accident.
yeah, I just had an accident. Man, I
That's
text this owner doctor, and you know what she said to me? She said, "Oh, I hope you're okay. Let me know when you can give me a makeup day." That's what she said to me. That was her. That's it. That was her
didn't even
first
hesitate. First thing out her mouth.
thing out of her
Okay,
mouth.
yeah. When can you come back to work?
That's exactly what she said. So that right there was kind of like, I think a switch went off, and I was just like, "Did she really just say that like to me?" Like she did. So that was it. And then COVID came. And then one of the DSOs I was working for, it was a big ordeal that, you know, they pretty much didn't want us to be protected, you know, during COVID. They didn't feel as though the things we were asking for, which were very reasonable things to protect ourselves, you know, during COVID, while we were working, you know, they made it seem like we were just asking for too much. So that was like the third thing for me that just kind of, I was just like, what am I doing? You know, I can do this on my own. It's just getting over that initial, you know, kind of, I guess, fear or whatever you want to call it, because it is a big step to step out on your own. And I built it from scratch, so.
But it sounds like you had the foundation from the work experience, from seeing how multiple different models, even within the DSO, multiple different business and practice models work. And like you said, you already had the ability or the experience of as a 1099 and having to keep track and inventory, money in, money out, and all that stuff. So you had a more of a foundation than a lot of, especially the young doctors that get roped into ownership, especially with the DSOs, get into. And you know, having owned offices myself, I feel like that is huge. When you can come in and you have some footing on business running and management and you know all the nuances of that, I think that definitely sets you up for success for sure. But I got a question. So as a specialist, there's a certain amount of educating you got to do to your general dentist, right? That could be one-on-one education, phone calls, some emails, but I'm sure you probably do study clubs, lecturing here and there. I think you lectured at the NDA a year or two ago, did something there. Yeah. One of the things that me and Walt have been talking about is what makes a good lecture? Because it seems these days, as someone that's been on the circuit for a while myself, there's a lot of people that think they should have a platform because they're popular, right? As opposed to putting on content that's really educational, both as far as the case presentation, the citation, the literature, kind of building an argument that's understandable and digestible. Do you feel, and me and Walt were just talking about this earlier, that enough general dentists, especially the ones that you work with, are investing time, energy, and an earnest effort to learn more? Even if it's not to learn to do what you do, but to learn about it so that they can properly refer to you at the right time, have those discussions with the patient so they're already coming to you jazzed up, informed, geared for what you're going to be offering them. What does that land look like for you in terms of educating both individually and kind of broader with study clubs and lectures?
Yeah, for me, in my private practice setting, it's mostly phone calls, you know, talking to the doctor, in between patients if I can, you know, going through x-rays and things of that sort. And then, like you mentioned before, I'm starting to get more involved with lecturing. So I lecture NDA, and I do NYU lectures, Bellevue GPR, and Bronx Lebanon GPR. And those lectures go really well, and they're received really, really well. And in my format of lecturing is just try to put the main points up there, and then just try to fill things in to kind of tell that story so people can understand it. And I don't want to ever talk to anyone like I know more than them or I'm better than them. It's just my perspective based on, my training and my experience. I've got a decent amount of root canals under my belt now, so I feel like I can talk about almost every situation, that's out there. But there's still things that happened for the first time. I actually saw a patient today, and I was just like, I've never seen this before. And I said it out loud. I didn't mean to say it, but it just took me aback. Like, it's like this is the first time, and it's good because there should be a first time for everything, right?
You should
Because you
continue to
can't do
learn.
everything. But to go back to what you were saying, Leroy, I think that it's kind of 50-50. I think some people are open-minded; they're ready to hear what you have to say, especially if you have evidence to back it up. And then some people, no matter what you've got to say, it doesn't matter. Their mind's made up. They're right. You're wrong. I consult with Walt via text sometimes, and I'll say, "Man, what do you think about this case?" And I think it needs cranial lengthening. And I'll tell the GP, I'm thinking you might want to do some cranial lengthening here, and they'll fight with me and they'll argue with me. A patient comes back to me, it hurts every time they're biting because they're biting on their freaking bone. Excuse my French, but I had a guy, man. I showed him a CBCT of the tooth biting on the bone, like the crown's laying on the bone. He said, "Maybe it's the angle of your X-rays." I said, "Excuse me, doc, but this is a three-dimensional, depiction, and I didn't angle this at all."
I got all the angles. I got all of them.
Just conversations like that, him and I finally, came to terms. But it's just some people, like you said, they're more receptive, they want to learn, but then some people is just, "Oh, I've been doing this, 35 years, I know everything," type of situation. Or even some people that are fresh out, they think they know, so much, which is that's the one, those are the ones that shocked me the most. The ones that have been practicing like a year and they're like, "Oh, I already know how to do everything." And I'm like, "Well, then why'd you send them to me?"
Great. So I want to ask, a lot of people, you said this early, you said that when you go to these offices, it's kind of like a built-in patient pool. But whenever you opened your office, especially the way you did, which was brand new, completely just went to a place, built it, and said, "We're open," right? That didn't come with a selection of patients. There's two questions I have. One, did you find yourself getting referred by the dentist that you had previously worked with? Did those dentists actually refer to your new office, or did they say, "Nope, I'm going to start to keep everything in-house still," meaning I'm not sending this out to Dr. Scott, even though I know what Dr. Scott's quality of work is, even though I know that Dr. Scott was just seeing that patient for another tooth, I'm still not going to refer that out because I want that money in-house, right? And then did you find it difficult to try to gather patients with them knowing that you had worked in different corporations throughout the Houston area?
Okay, so I'm gonna start off with. So we started a practice, de novo. I have a partner, Dr. Sarah Quang. She's originally from Houston, so she knew a lot of general dentists already in the area. So she was kind of like a great resource as far as us starting our initial, referral base, outside of the corporate, dentist that I had met. As far as the corporate dentists, for the most part, they want to keep everything in house. They only are gonna, send it out if it's a case, like I said, that endodontist just can't do, or if it's like an emergency and the patient needs to be seen like right then and there. But for the most part, they're going to try to keep it in-house. If they're a good GP, they can, and they feel confident, they'll probably do like the pulpotomy or pulpectomy procedure to just get the patient out of pain and then reschedule them to get the endodontics completed. But I do have some, well, I have a ton of DSOs surrounding my office. And then one of my classmates owns one of them with his wife, and they do send me patients. It's not like they send me all their patients because they run a DSO office, but they do send me patients because they know me personally, and they probably send other endodontist patients when I can't see their patients as well. But for the most part, I'm going to say most DSOs are trying to keep any and everything they can, within their four walls.
And the reason why I mentioned this, sorry, Dr. Horton, the reason I mentioned this, because a lot of people I think are naive to think if you leave their office, you have such a good rapport with that doctor that they're gonna love you no matter where you go. Oh, I know there's great endodontists. No, they forget the second you leave, they forget about you, and it's on to the next one, you know?
That's all facts right there, because once I started challenging them, that's the word I like to use, started challenging them, not doing everything they wanted, how they want it, operating the way they want it, working basically till 9 o'clock at night sometimes. That's when they've already started putting other endodontists in the offices that I'd go to. I've been going to some of the offices for 5, 6 years, and I've been killing it, seeing 8, 9 patients every time I come, 5, 6 years. And then there's another guy coming on a day I'm not here. And I'm like, what's going on? How come now my patient load's starting to, go down a little bit by little? And it's because it's a corporation. If I'm not falling in line with the way they want to run things, they're going to just find another, and I can't blame them. They're endodontists coming out of school every year, so they're looking for opportunities, and they're going to come down, so you have to find something that fits.
Does endo see the same race to the bottom that a lot of parts of dentistry sees? If you drive through California, you'll see all four wisdom teeth plus IV sedation, $999. Implants, $399. Do you see that same culture in endodontics, or have you guys been able to still be a little bit more protective of your kind of the integrity of your field?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I actually have never seen something like that for endodontics. So I'm gonna have to say
Really?
no. I'm gonna have to say no. I personally have never seen a, $3.99, get your root canal. I've never seen that. I've never seen that before. Free teeth whitening, if you got PPO insurance. I've never seen that before,
Have you but here's the question. Have you seen that not from endodontists, but from general dentists who want to do root canals, basically giving them discounts from that point of view, not from endodontists? Because I've never really seen another periodontist say, I'm going to give you a discount on this and this, but I've seen general dentists that want to do implants given bunch of discounts.
That's probably out there, but I haven't actually seen it advertised. I've seen other things like Leroy
Right,
said. I've seen those.
implants.
I've literally seen those other advertisements for sure, but I've never seen that for root canals. So that's interesting. I'm on the look now. I'm gonna be
Now
watching.
that's awesome, man. One thing that I've always appreciated about endo, you have to be extremely meticulous, and you have to be able to be laser focused for an extended period of time in a very small field of surgery, right? And I mean, to a certain extent, all of us as dentists have to do that. But when you're talking about endodontics, you truly talk about microsurgery, right? When the moment you say, I need a microscope to do this, that's micro laser focus that you're, hour, 2 hours. Is that a personality type that attracts someone to endo, or is that something you can kind of train or learn everybody into? Just that type of maintenance of focus and quality over time.
And can you also add on to that real quick? Sorry, I want to make sure that I can you add explain why you need a microscope? Because I feel like some people that may not know anything about root canals, why is a microscope so important for you guys in your field as
Yeah,
well?
of course. So I'm gonna touch on Leroy's subject first. I think it has to be some type of personality trait within all of us, because to be an effective, efficient, well-run endodontic practice, you got to be clean, you got to be organized, you got to have a system in place. And I feel like most of us, when we get in that setting, we all kind of have that similar, mindset. I'm gonna say most, because obviously there's always outliers, but most endodontists that I know, even if I don't know them personally, when I see the picture of them operating, their room looks, it might be slightly different, but it's really nice and neat and organized in a similar fashion. And I'm just like a real laid back guy, and I just like kind of like to know what the next step is going to be, even though each case is different, but the actual process is pretty much the same. It hasn't changed in, years. We got new toys and things like that, but it's pretty much the same as far as doing the root canal. And using a microscope, in my opinion, is like a, it has to be there. I just, now that I've been practicing, going on 10 years as an endodontist, I don't think I will ever, unless it's like an emergency situation, I don't have one around. Obviously, I can find a canal, whatever, but I don't think I'll ever do a root canal ever again without a microscope. It's just because it's like when you open your eyes, like, why would you close them? So I can see everything. I mean, I can see everything. And what makes the microscope so valuable, other than the fact that it literally magnifies what you're looking at, is the light. That light source, you can't replicate it as a dentist. You can't wear anything that has a light that powerful that can direct it in such a small, small space like that. So those are reasons we use a microscope in anodontics because of the actual literal magnification blowing things up, but it's just that UV light that's there is so bright you can't really beat it.
So you mentioned how, like, you know, you are in partners with your colleague, and you guys opened this practice together. Can you tell us the I guess the positive and negatives? And, you know, again, I'm going to say that I know Dr. Quang. I've known her for a very long time. She's a wonderful person. So there's nothing negative here. But what are some of the things that you have to kind of understand when you're in a partnership? Because that's not the case with a lot of dentists, with a lot of dentists who have practices. I think, Dr. Leroy, you had a partner. But that's not the case with, what, 90%, 95%. Would you say 90, 95% of dentists aren't in partnerships in an office?
It does seem like the majority of owners are solo owners.
That's it. That's it. Yeah. So can you explain to us, like, that mindset and how you kind of negotiate and kind of operate through that whole process?
I think, for like I was saying earlier, everyone's journey is different and everyone has different goals. Mm-hmm. So I have my own personal goals that I'm trying to achieve. I could have, but I didn't feel like I could have just jumped into a de novo brand new office just 100%, you know, because there's risk involved with that. What if I don't have patients coming in the door? You know, so I still have a family. I still have to feed them. So I had to kind of trickle my way in, is the word I like to use. So what better way to trickle in my mind than with another endodontist who could basically be in my office when I'm not there, but they have the equal, you know, they're invested just as much as I am. That's 50% their office, 50% mine. They want it to succeed. So they're going to do their best work and, you know, make the office grow. So I found someone who was basically in the same point of career as me and wanted to go in that direction as well. This is her home city, like I said, so she felt comfortable, like we would be successful. And we had a lot of conversations. It was like a year-long process, man, just to get, you know, get the thing open, you know, and then COVID hit. So that kind of threw things for kind of a loop as well. We opened up literally like October 2020. So COVID was kind of rampant, you know, throughout that time. But having a partner is great for me and my personality because it allows me to kind of delegate the top line stuff, like the really important stuff. I don't have to do it all, you know. And then even as an owner, Leroy, you know, you may have systems in place, but you still kind of got to check, because if you don't check, things might not be getting done. You might think they are, but sometimes right. They slip. And then when it slips, I tell my team, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. So, you know, if somebody don't add that other one, we don't have two, you know. So
that's true. Just,
you know, those little things add up over time. But for us as owners, what does that end up in? It ends up in less collections. You're collecting less money because the system broke down somewhere, you know, a treatment didn't get completed or patient didn't get scheduled appropriately, whatever have you. So having that other person to be on the top with me takes a little bit of the load off my shoulders, because it's a lot. Owning a private practice is a lot, you know, even though I had that 1099 experience or whatever, it's not the same. It's just not, you know. You're the end all be all. Everybody's coming to you. They're running to you with all the questions, and then you better have the solutions or you got to find them, you know? So having somebody there with me really helped me get through it, manage it. Because I was getting comfortable being in that 1099 role, because it was easy. You know, it was just show up, do my work, go home, get paid. And I was getting paid well. I'm not going to say that I wasn't. It's just the other stuff started adding up, you know, and I could see that it was affecting me as a clinician, as a practitioner. I wasn't who I wanted to be, because it was like, how you doing? I'm Dr. Scott. You're here to get a root canal. You know, let me give you a diagnosis. This is the treatment plan. You know, it was too fast. I couldn't really talk to them. Some of the offices were a little older, or, you know, or things didn't work properly. Just the flow of how I was operating, I didn't like it. And I could feel my body aching because I wasn't sitting in good dental chairs. Some of those offices have like straight up, you know, Staples office chairs is there.
No shade at Staples, by the way. I just I don't want to, they're too big.
But you get what I'm saying. They didn't have proper equipment, proper setup. So that little thing started, like I said, over years, it started adding up. So having a partner really helped as far as that goes, and it still helps to this day. You know, if I do want to go on a vacation with my family, I don't have to worry about my office being closed for a week. She's there, you know, to take up the slack. Now, there are negatives, like Walter brought up. It's like, I joke about it, but it's almost like I have two wives. You know, I got my wife, and then I got my business partner. She happens to be a woman, you know, so I say that, but I'm not married to two wives. I don't have two
No, no,
kids.
no, 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 no,
I mean, no, but in a sense, you are, because I've always said a partnership is a marriage,
That's
right?
it.
I was married to a guy, right?
Okay, okay, again. Again,
Partnership,
again.
right?
You see, I always have to
I
tell
check
him,
all the boxes.
he's gotta say pause. He doesn't say
on
pause.
that.
It makes
Oh,
everything.
we say no Diddy now. We say
Yeah, we
no
say no
Diddy.
ditty. That is true.
But
That's why you want to wrestle you with no shirts on. I saw
thank you. Thank
that
you. See, it's
But no.
listen, listen. I have got about like two or three videos just cocked and loaded, and I'm dropping one weekly. So it's gonna get worse and worse and worse, brother.
You know what's sad is he actually does this to himself. No one tells him to post these weird workout videos. He does it to himself. I literally could go on his feed and just make videos for years, but I'm trying to take the higher road, and I have too
Okay,
much.
that's
I
what
have he
it is.
has way more
Well,
time on his hands than
I'm
I do.
glad you're watching my shirtless videos, Walt. I appreciate the fanfare.
I'm going to tell you, Leroy, I bought my ticket to Vegas. I will be in
Let's go.
the NBA. But yeah, back to what I was saying. Dr. Quang is she's great, you know, as far as like marketing. She comes up with amazing marketing ideas where we don't pay anybody to do our marketing. We do our own marketing. You know, she's really good with just managing the team and things of that sort. So like I said, it's things that I'm weak at, she's good at, and things that she's weak at, I'm good at. So it kind of works out. But yeah, at the beginning it was a lot of stress, a lot of headaches, because we were still trying to get to know each other from an actual business partner standpoint. You know, she had her visions of how things should be. I had mine. So you got to come kind of in the middle and compromise. And then, you know, how we are as dentists, you know, we all have a similar personality type A of some sort. So it's like if things aren't going exactly the way we want, you know, it can drive, you know, to different levels of crazy, you know. So that was kind of hard for me. Like I say, for about the first year, you know, well, 2 years, because it took a year to even get open. So like the first like 2 years of us, you know, starting that relationship, it was just getting to know each other, learning how to communicate with one another. So that we could, you know, be successful. But now we're, you know, like I said, we're in year four, and I feel like we're in a pretty good place, and we still have more room to grow. I'm excited about our practice. We built it out with four operatories. We started off with just two, and then we got to the third one. We've been there, so I'm hoping pretty soon we're in op four, and you know, things keep going that way.
What do you say to people that, because everyone is pushing ownership on everybody, right? And you've kind of had both positions. You've been in a W-2 or all positions, 1099, and now you're own boss. Is it for everybody? Should that be the gold standard, the American dream of dentistry is owning your own office? Or is it really, should it be tailored to whatever your temperament is? Do you have the temperament for this at this point in your life, knowing that that could evolve down the road? Because it does seem like the messaging from the moment you graduate is, oh, you need to get out and as soon as you can, open your own office so you can have equity and blah, 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 blah. Is that true? Or do you think you should, hone your skills first, and then if you want to venture into entrepreneurship?
I definitely think it's case by case for sure. But looking back on my own journey, I appreciate, you know, being able to go to all these different offices and have all these different experiences and things like that, because it just helped me, you know, be a better dentist for sure. But looking back on the journey, I think I would have, if I could do it over again, I probably would have just started my own practice earlier, you know, and just kind of went through the ups and downs, the lumps and the bruises of being, you know, your own boss earlier. Just because, like you said, the equity or the potential to, you know, sell that office or whatever, but I just would have had it already earlier in the game. I don't regret anything I did, because like I said, I had a lot of experiences, and I saw a lot, you know, and I got to see behind the scenes of things. And I'm the kind of guy, I don't like to talk about something that I've never done. So that was another thing that pushed me to being an owner, because everybody was talking about being an owner, and I couldn't really tell you because I had never done it. But now that I'm in it, my temperament, now that I am an owner, I actually prefer not being the owner. I actually prefer going to work and going home, and that's it. I mean, I'm just being honest. I'm gonna be honest with you. I've been doing it
it.
now 4 or 5 years. It's great, and I do it, and it challenges me. So that's why I keep doing it. And I love my practice. I love walking in there, set up the way I want it to be set up. Everything is, you know, all the tech that I need is there, et cetera, et cetera. But it's just a lot of stress, man. You know, and it never really ends, you know, because you got to do notes afterwards. You got to balance the books. You got to check inventory. You know, there's always something. So, Something now, all of a sudden, you know, I'm in year four, things are starting to break, and you know, stuff's expensive. Yeah, stuff's expensive, man. You know, so that part is the part I don't like. So I just tell people it really depends on you, and there's nothing wrong with, you know, if you don't want to be an owner, you can still have a great life. It just all depends on what's, you know, what's important to you.
Okay.
So this is gonna be my last question. And I want you to talk to non-dentists out there, right? Whenever you go to an office and they talk about being able to have all the specialists under one roof, so you don't have to go anywhere. That's the dream that they sell to patients, right? Because they're like, look, you don't have to travel anywhere. We have everybody here. Now, I want you to talk to people that are non-dentists and explain to them what the benefit and the cost to that is, right? Meaning, is it really as great as people expect it to be and as great as people think it should be, right? Because we have expectations. If someone tells me I don't have to go anywhere, humans by nature are pretty, we'll call it lazy, for right? We don't want to do anything that we don't have to do, right? And that's kind of like what, you know, DSOs, corporations have kind of geared everything towards. Hey, your patients don't want to go anywhere. Right. And this is a new concept. This wasn't like this 10, 15, 20 years ago. Right. It was acceptable to just go to another office, to the endodontist, to the periodontist, whatever it be. Now it's, oh, you can just stay here. And that's kind of what we've shaped this society to look like for dentists and specialists. What are some of the things that people may not think about if you're a regular patient looking at this idea?
Well, one, I think it's all case by case. I think there are some offices that have everything under one roof and they're doing an amazing job and they're providing an amazing service to their patients. But generally speaking, I'm going to go out on a limb, maybe not, and say that's probably not the case. You know, you got people like myself or surgeons, you guys, periodontists coming in like once a month sometimes and then just setting up shop and then leaving. There's no, you can't follow up with the patients. You don't get that personalized care. You might not have all of the equipment you need or supplies that you need at that given office. They didn't order it or whatever have you. Or like I mentioned earlier, your specialist is here doing a surgery on you with someone who's never assisted in that procedure ever again. Would you go to a brain surgeon or a cardiologist and let him say, oh, this person's going to work with me, but they've never done it before? How would you feel? It's the same. That's the same thing in the dental corporation. Sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes that's what's going on. And of course, we're professionals, so we handle it like, you know, they're with us every day, even though they have no idea what they're doing. But, you know, it's little things like that that, you know, are immeasurable that could make a difference in your, you know, your outcomes. For me as the endodontist, it was, you know, that I have all the things I needed to actually, you know, do the procedure appropriately, and that I have the time, you know, that I needed, because everything can't be done in 45 minutes or an hour. Some things take 2-3 hours or two visits, you know? So that's where I kind of would say you might want to have a little bit more attention paid to. And also maybe if you're going to one of these, you know, DSO settings, look at the specialist or the dentist and see how long they've been there. You know, have they been there a long time? Is this their, you know, are they going anywhere anytime soon? Or is this office just flipping over people left and right? That should be kind of a red flag, at least to me, that, you know, maybe this isn't the place, you know, for me. But like I said, there are some offices that I personally worked in. They ran a good shop, you know, and they took care of their patients and they communicated well with them and with me. They made sure I was in the loop, you know, things were going on with their patients. And that's how it should be. But it's just some of those offices have so much turnover that they've got to retrain the front desk every, you know, quarter, or retrain the office manager every 6 months. Or I went in one office, they had a new office manager every single year for 6 years straight. You know, just turnover. And I mean, these people are coming from Starbucks, Home Depot, and next thing you know, they're right. You know, they're dental office managers. You know, so stuff like that, those little things make a difference.
And I'm going to say, and before Dr. Horton, you can speak on your whatever you want to talk about, but I want to just say that we kept mentioning corporations and DSOs, but this model is the same for private practice too. A lot of private practice general dentists are now starting to incorporate the mindset of bringing specialists into the office too. So I just want to make sure that everybody, no one's going to at us and say we were unfair to just corp. We're not, we're unfair to everyone. We're equally unfair, right? We basically tell you as it is. We tell you the truth, and the truth is this is happening in general and in dentistry in general, right? It's happening in dentistry.
I stopped working at a few like private nice private dental general practices offices, because like I said, the first couple of times I go in there with my loops, I had the big loops, you know, with the light and all that. But at some point there's a limitation to that. So I tell them, you know, we got to invest in microscope stand. I already have the opticals, but you got to get a microscope stand. And it was pushback, you know, on that, or, you know, or I need more, better digital X-ray capabilities, things, little things like that, just to make the patient's experience better, to make my, you know, make what I'm doing go, you know, more smoothly. And just having the equipment I need, because I can only bring but so much stuff with me in my trunk. You know what I mean? So it's
Right,
like at some
right.
point you got to invest, and that's where the line gets drawn. But I'm sure there are general dentists and private practices out there that are investing if they're bringing their specialists in. They may give them a whole closet so they can basically stock up everything they need, and you know, like have a microscope stand, things like that. I just would warn anybody. This is obviously biased from an endodontist. You know, if you're going to get your root canal, especially a molar, mainly a molar, if you're getting a molar and they don't have a microscope, you might want to just think about that.
No, that's facts. That's facts. And this is coming from somebody who's been doing this for a very long time too. So we have to take the advice of people who know what they're talking about. So.
Absolutely. Well, my last question is going to divert from some of the clinical and business stuff we've been talking about. And one of my thing, you went to an HBCU, and about, I want to say, like 70 to 80% of the young Black students go to like three or four schools, right? It's Howard, Meharry, Tufts are like the three top ones. But what we do see when we look at the ADSAS numbers is that of the applications to dental schools, there's 5% of them are Black, and the enrollment is around 4.5 to 5%. So we're proportionally represented in the application pool. What can we do? Because we're losing a lot of kids on the STEM track in middle school and high school. What can we do to make dentistry sexy and appealing? Because medicine has TV shows. My days it was Saint Elsewhere and ER and so forth. Now there's Grey's Anatomy and House and all those. We have nothing to sell ourselves. So of the young Black, brilliant minds out there that are wanting to get into healthcare, we're often never even on the decision table. So what, if anything, have you been doing, or what ideas do you have for us to really engage and sell dentistry as a viable option so we can get that representation and then the, more positive patient outcomes within our community?
Yeah, I think it's gonna kind of start two ways. The first way is what a lot of people are already doing, which is on like social media. They're putting, you know, their product out there. It mostly is cosmetic stuff, of course, but that's one thing to just draw eyes in. Like, you know, you're drawing eyes in, and then who's doing that work? And then, you know, it's a face that looks like one of us that's doing the work. So that's the first thing I think that you got to use what the kids are drawn to, which is social media. Bring them in that way. And then obviously you can go into the school systems and try to encourage them to get into dentistry as far as an actual career path. But to me, I personally think social media is, unfortunately for our age, the thing that is going to reach the most people nowadays. Even people our age, some people our age, that's how they get all their information. They don't
Right.
even, you know, take any other source into account. So
Right.
you have to leverage it, you know, in some
Right.
way. I remember Walter and I had a conversation about you guys' podcast. I'm like, you got to just start blasting that thing every site you can, just so eyes get on it, you know,
Right.
because
Sure.
that's just
Right.
the way the world is,
Sure.
unfortunately. And I think that's the biggest thing. So I appreciate the dentists who are, you know, putting their work out there, but they're putting a little flair to it because, you know, a little music behind it or like a little dancing video, stuff like that, which is just, that's just what the culture is right now. But that's all it takes to get somebody to say, oh man, I want to be like them, or oh, you don't have to be just a straight nerd. You could be a regular person and be a dentist, you know, stuff
Right,
like that.
right.
Unfortunately for us though, I think people really get turned away from it because of the experience that they have. You know, they'll as a kid, you know, they'll go to a dentist who may not give them the best treatment experience, whether it be from pain or whatever have you, and that just sticks with them, you know, and that sticks with them forever. So they're just like, they don't like the dentist, they don't care who you are, you know. So I think it has to start with, you know, more of us providing care to more of us and giving more of us that, you know, that experience where they're like, man, that's a respectable job. He's doing a good thing, and I want to do the same thing, you know, in my community.
Man, that's dope. That's actually, man, we'll stop right there. And I mean, that was incredible. So thank you for coming on, start off with. I want to say that.
Absolutely.
Real quick though, I do have one other thing. Do you think Dr. Horton is helping dentistry with his shirtless workouts? Do
Hey,
you
look,
think
I bought my ticket
he
today.
gets eyes on dentistry, right?
Do
Hey,
you think
I'm there.
that he is helping or hurting dentistry with his shirtless workouts?
Hey, it's I think it's just bringing eyes to the field. You know, that's what we're trying to do.
That's it. Even if they in the end they don't want to be dentists, the eyes are going to the field.
You know what's funny about that, Dantra, is you know how back in the day, if you met someone on social media, you kind of cyber stalk them and go way back into their photos. If you accidentally like something from like 5 years ago, you're a weirdo, right? My boy Walt literally pulled a photo from like 5 or 6, or a video from 5 or 6 years ago.
Stop
So
lying. This was
he
last
was
week.
definitely
This was
scrolling
last
on
week.
my page
You know
for a
what?
good minute trying
The funny thing is, I could actually
to.
show you that this man, he thinks that this is what he doesn't realize that he posts so many of these on the regular that he thinks this was posted by this was literally last week. But anyway, no.
I'm looking forward to you guys speaking in Vegas at the NDA. I'm
Yeah,
sure it's
for
going to
sure.
be great, man. I really am.
No, I,
Yeah,
you know, we joke a lot.
we'll have to organize a night or two for of us to just hang out, man. Just
Oh yeah, we're gonna.
no,
Have
the
but
whole
you
cir the
know,
whole circle of us and just have a night.
I wanna say that we joke around a lot, but you know, Dr. Scott here has already presented and did an excellent job last year at the NDA. So we're just following in the same footsteps, and you know,
Absolutely.
we joke around a lot. But I mean, I definitely appreciate this man for everything he's done to be board certified, to be a lecturer, to have his own practice. I think it's incredible, and we want to make sure that we highlight that more than anything else. You know what I mean? But yeah.
Absolutely.
Appreciate that. Thank you guys again for having me on. And anyone who's listening, if dentistry is the way you want to go, it's an excellent field. You really do help people, and you can provide yourself with a good lifestyle. But it is a lot of work, and you got to be willing to put it in, just like any other job. There's going to be up days, there's going to be down days, but at the end, you are providing a quality service to the population.
Right. So if someone needs a root canal, where could they find you, brother?
I'm at Heights Endodontics in Houston, Texas, and my Instagram page is at Heights Endo. You guys can find me there on Instagram.
What's
And
up?
I know you've mentored a lot of students, a lot of people that have come through your office as well, you and Dr. Quang. So that's another thing that people can absolutely do. And we'll put your information in the show notes, but that's something that I think is very, very valuable because as an endodontist, I know you guys. I mean, you guys do help a lot of people. You see patients that are in pain or miserable, and you put
Right.
them out of pain. So that's something that I think a lot of people need to understand. So thank you, sir, for coming on. Appreciate you as always, brother.
All right, guys, you
All
have a good
right.
night.
All right. Thank you for listening to this episode of Tooth Be Told. The opinions on this episode are just that, our opinions. Please consult your dental professional before taking any action with your dental health. If you have any questions about anything you heard on this episode, please contact us at Real Dentist with an S. That's REAL Dentist with an S at gmail.com. We would be very happy to return any message that we receive because we love the communication that we have with our listeners.